Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 41 for March 26th, 2013. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me as always. This is the final installment in my State of Games series of shows, and this one has a little bit of a story attached to it. I intended to release this episode before leaving for the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, but that was before Mother Nature sent a foot of snow my way. Hearing the forecast and fearing that I'd miss my flight, I left the night before the flight hoping to beat the storm, and of course didn't. Basically just drove right into it. So a drive that should have taken me 45 minutes took me a little over 4 hours. And, you know, there were cars sliding all over the place. There was a semi jackknifed, closed part of the interstate. It was a nightmare. So needless to say, I wasn't able to post the podcast. I'd copied the files to my laptop and took them with me to San Francisco, where I'm recording this now using the little internal mic on my computer. So this part may not sound great, but I'm getting the show to you with the important part unaffected. And that important part, of course, is my conversation with Kirk Hamilton of Kotaku and Brett Duville of Bethesda Game Studios. We discuss all sorts of things germane to the topic that I'm exploring in these roundtables, and I think you'll agree that Kirk and Brett do a nice job of wrapping up the series for me. So my thanks to both of them, and thank you, as always, for listening. I hope you enjoy the show, and away we go. I am very happy to welcome two guests to the podcast, one a frequent visitor and one a brand new visitor. I'll start with the new one because I'm especially thrilled to have Brett Duville join me. Brett is the lead programmer at Bethesda Game Studios. He's been there for about 5 years or so.
Yep, coming up on 5 years this June, July. And thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've known you for some time. We were just talking before we started recording that I can't figure out for the life of me why I haven't had you on the show sooner, because I met you a few years ago and so we sort of hit it off. And I love what you guys do. And I'm interested in your work. And it just makes no sense at all to me that I haven't had you on the show yet.
You know, we were busy flying dragons and things like that. It happens.
It happens. Brett was some years before was at LucasArts in the late 90s, I think early 2000s.
Yeah, I started in the late 90s and I ended in the mid aughts.
Yep. It's great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And also Mr. Kirk Hamilton, features editor at Kotaku, who's been, like I said, a frequent guest, a longtime friend, going back to his Gamer Melodico days. You've been at Kotaku going on 2 years? Is that right?
We're getting there, I guess. It's like a year and three quarters now or something like that.
Kirk is also a jazz musician, a composer, a sax player. I just found out before we started recording that Brett was also a sax player. So
once
I think this is important,
yep.
You know, important information. It, partly because, you know, sax players have cool in their DNA, right?
That is very true. I think you have to be cool to play sax.
Totally. Have you ever met an uptight sax player?
I have met a few, actually. But
really?
They're rare. Yeah,
yeah, they're rare.
But I've met a lot of saxophone players. So.
Well, it's really great having you both on. Thanks for making time. If I don't know when people will listen to this, but it's Friday night and I know sometimes people like to do fun things on Friday night, so I appreciate you guys making time for me and recording with me this evening.
Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, and I'm on West Coast time, so it's no big deal.
Okay, yeah. Well, this series of podcasts, I've mentioned it before in the other segments, is kind of a broad conversation about kind of the state of games, and I thought I'd launch with just a general kind of insight to see if you guys agree with me or see it differently. You know, I'm thinking back on some of the conversations I've had over the last few days.
It's easy to get into a kind of a hand-wringing mode about a variety of things, you know, studios closing and sales down. People seem confused about this transitional period, and the indie space seems to be blowing up, but no one can quite make any sense of it. And it's a kind of a crazy transitional time. But I can't think of a time that I've been playing games that it's been sort of more interesting to be around this space. That there's so much interesting stuff going on. It's going off in so many directions. So many great games to play, especially recently. And I just think, I mean, maybe this is like a little Candide, but this is like the best of all possible times.
Yeah, I feel totally the same. I mean, I feel like I should come on and be like the president and say the state of games is strong. You know, it just, you know, it's strong, but it's turbulent for sure. You know, and I think when you've got that much positive force going, you're going to naturally have some sort of back eddying and things like that, where it's maybe not all positive. But I think even the stuff that is not entirely positive is often soul searching or making us question ourselves, and I think that's nothing but healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely. It's funny. I feel sometimes like I'm not a very cynical dude, but I think that working at Kotaku, like, you know, writing that much news, writing it the way that we write, it's definitely made me more cynical over the last year, and just dealing with so much PR and marketing, which is all just can make you very cynical. But when I actually, like, I'm, you know, I've never been deeper in anything than I am in, like, the sort of what's going on in the gaming scene right now, just writing for this site. And I definitely feel like there's so much interesting, exciting stuff going on all the time. That, yeah, there's, like, a lot of crap and there's a lot of sort of malarkey around it. And there's also, yeah, like Brett said, there's also sort of negative things that are happening, and change kind of always brings about that kind of thing. But there's so much exciting new stuff going on and so much potential that, yeah, I can't help but be excited about everything that's going on.
You know, I asked Tom Bissell yesterday. I'll ask you the same question. You assume that when someone goes from sort of an outsider to insider, or at least in his case, maybe from a journalist or a critic, and then sort of becoming a part of the industry, writing inside the industry for a game, that inevitably involves becoming sort of dark and cynical, that all of your sort of, you know, rose-colored glasses kind of come falling off. But he says it's the opposite for him, and I sense that it's the opposite for you, that you aren't a cynical dude, and you haven't become a cynical dude since you went to Kotaku.
I talk to Tom about that sometimes, too, that the idea that, like, he, you know, because he went from being a critic to actually trying to write games and understanding how difficult it was. You know, I haven't done that, but to go from sort of being a, you know, a jazz teacher and part-time blogger to you know, getting really, really neck deep in it. Yeah, I think that if you're paying attention anyways, there's so much awesome positive stuff to write about that by and large it isn't SimCity's launch and like EA screwing over customers, right? Like, it's not like that's the big story this week, but that's not. There's so much cool stuff going on. There's so many people who care about games, so much love and like positivity and creativity happening and change that. Yeah. If you, the minute you're really deep in it, you can just find so much of it that it's really cool. It's really heartening.
You must have mad programming skills with long experience in, you know, businesses that have been successful. Brett, have you ever been tempted to leave?
I think it's all, there's always a temptation to, you know, to look at other things, but I think I learned, you know, there were a few years between leaving LucasArts and joining Bethesda where I was a consultant and things like that and was working from home a lot. And what I learned about myself then was that I'm extremely collaborative. I really enjoy working with teams of artists and teams of designers. And when you're working at home, especially as a consultant programmer, you're mostly talking to other programmers, and that's, you know, I love talking with programmers, but it's not all I want to do. So there is an appeal to that, but it really isn't probably where I'll end up at any point in my career, not in the near future anyway. Mm. I've just always found that not only do I enjoy sort of the large scale tasks that we tackle, but also the mentoring and working with more junior programmers or even other senior programmers. You know, coming to Bethesda, I have some people that I work with that I've learned a ton from, about, you know, parallel processing and concurrent programming and things like that, that were pretty new this generation. It was good to kind of see that a few years back and say, yeah, you know, I'm not sure that's for me. I do a lot of hobbyist programming still, and that's kind of how I get that out if I'm not doing a lot of programming at work.
Has the culture of the video game industry changed from your end of it in the years that you've been there?
In some degree, I'd say it has, mostly because of scale. And I'm actually, well, two types of scale. So team scale. You know, I work still on a team that is for AAA relatively small. I mean, we're around 100 people. And that's still small enough that I can know everybody, you know, by name in the development team and in the company at large by sight. And that was true at LucasArts when I was there. You know, we had a few hundred total people, total employees, at LucasArts when I was there. You know, that's a lot different than, say, Ubisoft or whatever, where there might be literally hundreds of people on a team at the end. So I haven't kind of seen that top end of the scale that we see in AAA currently. And the other scale that I was talking about is that, of course, you know, the sort of bets are larger. There's a lot more, you know, investment interest, the sort of stockholder interest. I mean, seeing THQ go under recently certainly reinforces the fact that the industry has changed since I joined it. But I've always worked with a private publisher, so that's kind of a different world in that respect.
It relieves you of a certain pressure that other places that aren't private face.
Absolutely. I mean, at LucasArts, we had George and the Star Wars, you know, war chest that we could fall back on, and you know, at Bethesda, we've enjoyed a lot of success that's quite humbling, and that lets us kind of take our future into our own hands.
This is a question for both of you. I've heard this a lot, and people have remarked on it online and in conversation with me, that they see where we are now in the industry as kind of top and bottom ends as possibly viable, but the middle is getting real hard, that the AAA Bethesda-type places are going to be fine, and the indie scene is just blowing up, but it's those middle publisher developers that are finding it more and more difficult to survive in the marketplace. Do you see it that way, or is that a misperception?
It's funny, you know, I related to that talk is this idea that like these subsidiary studios that are smaller and sort of are brought on to work on tangential projects to the games or to make sequels, then get closed down right when the game ships or before the game ships. Like we just had this happen with Visceral Montreal, right? Where like they like laid everybody off and Army of Two isn't even out yet. And we kind of keep seeing this thing happen where a game ships and then everybody loses their job. And I'm curious to know, Brett, what you think of this too, that like, you know, you guys have a cool situation going, it sounds like, with Bethesda, you know, similar to another, like you have a lot of success. So you've got this thing to fall back on. But like, I have a lot of friends in Austin who just are constantly shifting around between studios because they keep getting laid off or their studio gets shut down. And it almost feels like this weird permutation of like the Hollywood film model where game development could become sort of like Hollywood where, you know, they don't get laid off after the movie and they don't have to keep working on the movie after the movie comes out. But it's this idea where like you make a movie and then the movie's over and then your job is over and you go get another job somewhere else. And that it works because they're all in Hollywood together in theory. So they've like got this geographical thing where game studios are kind of all spread out everywhere. So you'll just see people getting laid off from jobs that they flew their whole family across the country to take. And the whole thing feels like it's got these little clusters of localization, but it's spread out. I don't know. Like it's something that I'm curious about that I don't know a ton about because, you know, I don't work in development. But
yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, you know, especially you mentioned Austin, that is definitely a community that sees a lot of turnover.
Yeah.
But I think that also it reinforces itself in the sense that because there are so many studios there, it's also easier for people to jump ship, mm-hmm. you know, and move on or start their own thing or what have you. You know, maybe they go indie with a few friends that they've, you know, worked with for years or what have you. There is kind of that opportunity there because there are so many different opportunities and this sort of culture of turnover. We're different, I think. Not just because of our success, because I think there were some lean years before I came, but also because our culture is different in that respect, and we don't have a lot of turnover. You know, we were talking about it just this week that, you know, since Skyrim shipped, we've lost a small handful of people.
Oh, that's really cool. That's like kind of like the Tim Schafer was talking about that. I think just not. Or I think last fall maybe this whole idea of like quit firing people when your game is done. Like
right, yeah. Tim's a great guy. He actually was my gateway into LucasArts, you know, a long time ago.
Oh, right. I guess that makes sense.
And yeah, he's got a wonderful environment there. I think what you'll see is that kind of turnover will probably continue in the AAA space especially. And again, probably for those mid-tier business models. So In the sense that, you know, if you're making a game that's going to come out and it's relatively short and it doesn't necessarily have long legs to drive people to continue playing it, that model is probably going to not work as well in AAA in the future. Just because there's this huge, you know, used game market, for example. And so if your game is 8 to 10 hours, you know, that would have been fine 10 years right. ago, you know, where these sort of secondary markets were only just starting to open up. But today that just doesn't, that's really hard to work unless it's something that's not transferable, a downloadable game or something like that, right. like the Walking Dead folks.
Hmm. Or you see these weird things like they keep adding multiplayer to games that just totally don't need multiplayer, like in this weird kind of attempt to make the game have longer legs. But like Spec Ops: The Line's multiplayer, you know, that game just did not need multiplayer, and nothing about the game that was interesting. And there were interesting things. It was an interesting game, but the multiplayer wasn't interesting. And you could tell that this was someone saying, "Well, look, we need to fight used sales. Like, we need to justify that this thing is going to cost $60." So
that's putting multiplayer in it. The other pressure that happens there, you know, at LucasArts, at the time that we were putting out Republic Commando, you know, store owners would not buy games that didn't have multiplayer in them.
Wow.
So there was a retail channel that would just close off to you because you didn't have multiplayer in your, in particular, Xbox game. So it was something that, you know, we had to, I mean, I won't say we tacked it on. We put a lot of people on it. But it wasn't everything that it could have been had we started with it, you know, in mind from the beginning. And ultimately, I think it hurt us critically, you know. Oh, the multiplayer feels tacked on. Well,
right. You know. Which, yeah, still happens to a lot of games. Well, and it's funny, too, that they would say that because, like, look at Skyrim. Like, there's a game that didn't need multiplayer, you know, to sell well.
Nor a demo, for that matter.
You right.
know, it's true. You know, you can see our trailers and things, but there's no way for us to package our game into a demo. You know, it's literally, hey, you've stepped out of character gen, you know.
Right.
Go wherever. Have fun.
Right.
I know what you mean, Kirk, about that kind of tacked-on feeling with multiplayer. I see so many of the kind of core demographic types, which are mainly sort of my students, for those games, and I'm always shocked by how few of them seem terribly interested in the single-player mode of any shooter, that their immediate interest is the multiplayer. And even in a game where the multiplayer seems less interesting or developed, they gravitate toward it.
Interesting. So do you find, like, so even with games like where there's a clearly superior option, like with, you know, like Spec Ops compared to Gears of War or something, or compared to Call of Duty, like they would still be like, well, how's the multiplayer?
I think they default to multiplayer. I think it's a sort of post Call of Duty kind of mentality, you know, these kind of war shooters sort of, I think a lot of players just default to a multiplayer mentality. I'm always shocked by how few of my students actually complete or even make much headway into the solo campaign of
games.
Yeah,
I have that too. Do you ever feel just like, I feel really old fashioned when I write stuff about, like when I play like Black Ops 2 and I think, okay, well, the stuff I'm going to write about this game is going to be about the story, you know, and how the story falls short and stuff, and nobody cares. Like, they're just like, dude, why are you even writing about this? Like, this is just not what we're
interested in. Go write a story about a roller coaster. I mean,
right. It's like, they're just like, this isn't the game at all. Like, you're such an old fogey. And yet, like, all of us at Kotaku are like, whoa, but the story, you know, that's the thing that we want to write about. Yeah, I find that I feel really old fashioned when we do that.
I think part of that is the culture of developing those has, the single player has to be there to train you for the multiplayer. You know, and they may still have a market that is interested in the single player, although I don't think to nearly the degree that they had. I wonder whether, you know, if Half-Life 3 came out, if that would still be the story. You know, I sort of feel like there are games that have historically been about their single player experience. Like, Half-Life 2 probably has a multiplayer mode, but I never played it.
I think there's just, like, there's, like, some, it's like Source multiplayer or something. Like,
right,
it's not,
so yeah,
they said I have
a separate product, right. Yeah. You know, so it's sort of the original Half-Life and Half-Life 2 sort of raised that bar so high that competing on the strength of your single-player story, I think it's hard to differentiate that anymore.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's true. It's funny, like I get confused with that sometimes, like with Call of Duty, where I'll go to check out Black Ops 2 and they'll do this massive press event about the single player. And they have all these guys come out and they bring out all these writers. They talk so much about how the single player is such a big deal, especially Black Ops 2. It was like, oh, the story is going to be crazy. It's going to be timeline jumping and all this time travel stuff. They make a really big deal out of it. And they're trying to do some interesting stuff. Like, it doesn't feel like that multiplayer was really training for single player, you know? Like, in Black Ops 2, there was this whole, like, tactical gameplay mode that they added that there was no multiplayer component to it at all. It was just this weird kind of almost XCOM like squad management thing. Mm-hmm. And they added it was really ambitious. It didn't work that well. I didn't have very much fun with it, but it was ambitious, and you got the feeling, okay, these guys like single player games. They want to make a good single player game. That's what they're trying to do here.
Yeah, and I think it's ironically, they are able to carve out some experimental space for themselves in the middle of this very high-profile AAA game that needs to sell zillions of copies because, you know, that mode is the least noticed, if you know what I mean. I mean, people aren't going to buy it or not buy it, depending on how good that solo player mode is. So they might as well take a few risks. I mean, that space seems kind of wide open to me for them to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. I think Halo 2 probably is the console game more than any other that really vaulted that multiplayer experience to be front and center. You know, certainly before that, I mean, there were good multiplayer experiences before that. Don't get me wrong, but they added the whole, you know, metagame element, which was the leaderboards and the, you know, the website that tracked every, you know, single whatever multiplayer session that was played. You know, they had tons and tons of data that they were tracking. And I think that built a community that could extend past the single player game. In a way, the single player game is kind of like, and we can talk about this in context of the vintage game club, because it connects in a way. The single player game, it's really hard to have a water cooler conversation about if you don't all start at the same time and you don't kind of have reams of time, you know. So at work, it's often difficult for me to keep up with the conversation about any particular individual game unless it's relatively short, just because I don't have tons and tons of time. And I actually see this with playing the Vintage Game Club. It's hard to, I've been playing the System Shock 2, and it's hard to like know how to keep pace with other people who are at the same point as you and have that dialogue, you know. And so that's kind of an interesting part of it too, is that the multiplayer is an experience that it changes but doesn't really fundamentally change, whereas a storyline, you know, is kind of, well, there might be some big moments, you know, depending on how long that storyline is, it might be hard really to connect over it, because you don't want to share anything that's already happened. Yeah, share something that you've experienced that somebody else hasn't. But you can always talk about the multiplayer because it's, you know, we had a session and, you know, I got this cool headshot or whatever.
Yeah, you put your finger right on it. I think that's been the trickiest thing about the VGC is that when we first started it, we were very prescriptive about playing. We would play this much. We're going to look at this level. Everybody's going to play the same amount. Don't start the next one until everybody's there, you know. So we were able to have that kind of water cooler conversation. But you had to be very careful, and you had to really put barriers around people branching off into different things. And that just felt so restrictive, and people complained about it, and I totally got that. So we kind of opened it up and said, well, just go at your own pace and post in the right threads and we won't bump into each other. And for the very reasons you explained, it just kind of becomes impossible.
It's funny, you know, I feel like this is definitely true. Like, I mean, with writing about games in general, it's this big challenge where, you know, like with spoilers and what part you can talk about and what part you can't, and who wants to read about what and how far everyone's played, and you've played the game early, so maybe everyone isn't done. Like, all of that kind of stuff makes it really difficult to have conversations with games. Like, I go out and get drinks with a lot of, you know, game developers and game critics now, and we can't, like, our conversations are always so stupid. It's like that Portlandia thing about spoilers where everyone's saying, oh, well, don't spoil me, you know, and, you know, you'll be talking about Prince of Persia or something, or like The Sands of Time. It's like this game that came out forever ago, and everyone's like, oh, don't spoil me, don't spoil me. So it's hard to, like, have a kind of meaningful conversation where that's one of the things I really like about my friends. Tom actually is this way. A lot of journalists I know just don't care about spoilers at all. They're like, I just don't care. Just tell me what you want to tell me. And it's sort of this liberating feeling of, okay, like, I'm just going to tell you what happens at the end of Bioshock, even though I know you never finished it. What I liked, one thing that I thought was interesting, like, I think this whole social thing we're talking about right now is really interesting and is going to get even more so. One thing that I really liked about The Walking Dead was that it was released episodically, because that game was really easy for everyone to keep talking about as we played through it, because we had to wait like a month and a half or 2 months in between sections. So there was this whole period where everyone was talking about, like, you know, episode 2 or episode 3, the crazy stuff that happened in episode 4 or whatever, where we all knew we were in the same place. We knew we'd finished the last episode, and the game was kind of in progress, but we had a safe stopping point that was, like, mandated by the way the game was released. I thought that was really, really cool. It made me want to play more episodic games.
Yeah, I think that's really effective, and it's effective in the same way that the comic book itself is effective, mm-hmm. that it brings you up to these sort of big, I don't want to say climactic, but some big moments where
right.
anything could happen next.
Right, or a TV show, you know, that.
Yeah, the TV shows, I haven't watched.
Not the Walking Dead TV show. The Walking Dead TV show is not that good, but a TV show in general.
Right, soap operas, I mean, we make fun of them, but yeah. that's the principle, right? You leave them hanging.
Mm-hmm. Yep, every day. Yeah, so I think that was good. And they also tied in a feeling of community directly into it, with sort of showing what percentages of people
right.
would make decisions. So that sort of built in, if not a direct contact, at least I'm surprised I was against the majority in this such situation.
Right. I really like that kind of thing, like with single player, multiplayer, like that social aspect of single player games, I think is really cool. Like, we played, I was at Lee Alexander's house, this is like a year ago, in New York, and we wound up all playing Catherine together. And she just played it. Like, she held the controller for the most part and did the puzzles because she's really good at them. But then we played it as a group. It was a big room of people, and we're all kind of, you know, hanging out and having a drink and laughing and watching the game. And then there are these decision moments where you have to decide what to do, or, you know, do you text your girlfriend, or do you lie to her, or do you tell the truth? And we would all talk about them and decide what to do. And then the game did something similar too, where you'd make these moral choices and it would tell you how people answered. And it was really fun. I mean, it was a really engaging social thing that was, you know, not deathmatch.
Right. And the same you saw with the Demon's Souls. So you had these ways of communicating that were not, they were sort of massively single player in a way, or sequentially single player, and like they talked about with Animal Crossing way back in the day when it came out, whereas you had to play, right, you couldn't all be playing the GameCube at the same time, but you could all play in the same town,
right,
and
you could leave each other mail in your mailbox,
exactly, and gifts
and
all that sort
it's
of
like
thing.
It's like local asynchronous multiplayer.
Exactly, right, so that you had this sort of opportunity, and you're seeing that in different ways, I think, in a lot of these games, and those are the sorts of things that I think will connect with people and make them continue to play these sorts of games,
mm-hmm.
Especially these sort of. I think that's where the middle level game has to go if it's going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I know a lot of the people from Telltale, because they're all ex LucasArts, and they have really found a way to be at that sort of mid level. I mean, they're not tiny. You know, they're not like indie tiny, but they're not huge by any means.
Mm-hmm.
But they found a way to maintain a level of interest in their sort of episodic storytelling month to month that is hard to pull off. Mm-hmm. And certainly they've had successes and failures at that.
Mm-hmm.
When you guys are describing the kind of social dimension of the games that you're playing, most of what you're talking about is kind of serendipitous social stuff. It's engineered by the player with friends, and you create these spaces in between the games and while you're waiting for the next release, or, you know, playing it together, that sort of thing. It almost seems to me that that's inevitably more successful than the many attempts, at least so far, to sort of engineer the social stuff into the game, sort of forcing people to be social.
Right.
Or like, you can tweet about what you just did, or what these kind of lame, you know, the social media layer that you put on to games. Do you agree that players are three steps ahead of all that?
I think that players definitely take advantage of it, and it gives it a different energy. Like, I, you know, that game Time Surfer, did you guys play Time Surfer at all? iOS game?
No.
Oh, it's really good. You should play it. It's like a dollar or something. It's a lot like Tiny Wings. It's really, really fun, and it has an awesome soundtrack. The music is, like, so good. It's this, like, 1 10-minute track of just this epic synth music. It's really great. Anyway, so that game has that kind of thing you're talking about, Michael, like the Cannibalt thing where you could, I remember Cannibalt was the first game to do that, where you could tweet, like,
yeah.
I made my great escape and I made it this many feet or whatever it was, yards, which was kind of cool because it felt different, and I think people got into it, and it's a way to show off. Like, I think that's like an engineered social thing that people actually use sometime, and it's funny. Like, it, almost because every game tries to get you to do it. So when I actually see people that I follow on Twitter doing it, it means that it's something special, like they're communicating something extra on top of the fact that they did well at the game.
Hmm. Yeah, and but, I think that Sword and Sorcery or whatever,
yeah, that's what
did
I was
something
just thinking about.
Pretty well that way as well, where
right. Well,
if something made you
kind of
laugh or connect, yeah, at first it was a little too much. Yeah. But if it connected with you and you had the opportunity to tweet it, you know, that was the sort of thing. And there was an online text adventure game. I can't remember what it was called. I think it was European Night something. I don't remember what it was called. But it was the same sort of thing where I would occasionally see these snippets of very well written, very sort of tonally interesting places that they were describing. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm really interested in that game, you know, for the same reason.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, that kind of thing can work. But I think, like, I do think, Michael, the broader point you're making about, like, how the stuff that we do on our own is more powerful than anything that can be engineered is definitely true. I'm really interested in how SimCity is actually going to work if and when it actually starts working, because they've engineered social behavior into that game so much that it'll be really interesting to see how, you know, you really have to play that game with your neighbors. Like, you have to coordinate with other people to make your city work. And from everything I've heard, you know, Steven and Mike played the game a lot pre-release. It kind of really relies on this totally engineered cooperative play between you and someone else, not necessarily at the same time, which I've never really seen before. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how it'll work. I'm sort of curious.
Well, it does seem like the common thread, everything you see, Bungie's new game, and you look even the title of GDC talks and stuff, how to get this stuff into games, how to connect people, how to make the social dimension of gaming, how to exploit it, leverage your tools, these sort of things.
Right, right.
So I want to shift it a little bit. It's sort of impossible to talk about the state of games as we sit here now without talking about indie games and the kind of monumental impact that they've had. It's getting kind of difficult to even use that term indie game. It's become problematic, I think, because what does it even mean, and what is indie, and all that. We know people are having that conversation. But if we can just generally kind of wrap our arms around the idea that we kind of have a sense of what indie games are, what is the impact of that movement from your perspective, Brett, and maybe from yours, Kurt? I know it's a kind of a big fat question, but
yeah, it's a big question. I think it's definitely influencing designers that I work with pretty substantially, in the sense that they see interesting ideas. And I think Richard LaMarchand actually talked about this at GDC last year, maybe, where he was seeing things in games in the indie scene, and it was influencing how he thought about his big AAA games. And you know, I think that definitely happens to a large degree with us as well, though not in a sort of organized way. You know, we don't all go and play this game or that game. It's just sort of, we come across the stuff, and a lot of Bethesda folks are active in the IGF judging, just because of interest. I did the technical jury this year and last year, and I played dozens and dozens of games. You know, certainly some much better than others. And it's really interesting because you see a lot of techniques of people being very creative with you know, severely constrained resources, you know, and you know, even though our resources are certainly less constrained, I mean, we still, you know, one of Todd's, you know, mantras is, you know, we can do anything, we just can't do everything, you know. So he's very keen on identifying elements of a game that will work, you know, so that we can kind of push them into the fore. He talked about that, I think, at DICE last year as one of his points. And so I'd say we try to maintain that sort of aggressive, getting a lot done, getting it into the game early spirit that I think you need to have as an indie as well. I mean, you can't plan out some complicated system that's going to take you months and months and months and might pay off when you're an indie. And I think that if you start to rely on that too much as a AAA developer, you might run into the same problems. You know, if you have too many of those, you might just not get there. They might, maybe none of those bets will pay off. And I think it's a good reminder of kind of where we were 15 years ago. You know, the indie scene today is really team sizes, maybe more like 20. I started 15 years ago. We're already 20, 30 people on a team. But that's sort of the high end of indie developers now. So, you know, I definitely see that influence on us, you know, that we want to focus on getting the play experience as quickly as possible, even if it's rough, you know, and we... you know, we showed off tons of things that came out of Game Jam, some of which went on to be in DLCs. That was in very much that spirit.
Hmm. Yeah, I kind of find, I mean, I from a critical standpoint, like from just writing and looking at games, something that I think is really cool about the indie scene, you know, and yeah, like it's a word that's really loaded, and just like indie music, you know, but we all kind of know what it means, but everyone will debate what it means. Or like hipster, it's another one of those words.
I'll just mention, I'm sorry to interrupt you, I just want, because it's an opportunity. I talked to Chris Sullentrop yesterday, and he said he goes back far enough to remember that, you know, alternative music is essentially what indie games have become.
Yeah, right. Everything's alternative music. I remember alternative music. And we talk about, like, and that actually, what's funny is I think of alternative music and I totally think of that music from like 1994.
Yes.
Like, and so it doesn't, the word is completely taken on a new meaning. Just like I'm sure when we talk about indie rock in 10 years, like we'll totally think about whatever, you know, indie bands. We'll think about the Arcade Fire and like, it won't be like whatever is independent then. It'll be what was indie rock like right now. So,
anyway,
and like,
sorry,
indie
interrupted,
games.
But, yeah.
No, it's fine. Indie games are totally that same way. So, but anyway, what I like about this is something I was talking to a friend of mine, to Chris Remo, who I think you guys probably know Chris Remo, right?
Oh, yeah, he's sure.
He's an Idle Thumbs guy, right?
Yeah, he's an Idle Thumbs guy, really smart guy. We were talking about this idea of sort of responsibility or I guess accountability. He was saying that the idea of accountability in games development is this kind of messed up thing right now. Like there are still a lot of games getting made where you'll ask, okay, but why is this in the game? And the answer is just sort of, because it is, because it's in the game, just because we put it in the game. You know, like a classic example of this is BioShock Infinite and the fact that that game is about shooting hundreds of people. So you'll kind of, we keep asking Ken about this, like Steven's asked Ken about this, other reporters have asked Ken about this and said, well, okay, but why is the game about shooting? You've got all these really interesting historical themes and you're talking about race stuff and all this wild sort of metaphysical stuff. Why is the game just shooting people? You know, just like in BioShock, why was that your thing on objectivism about shooting people? And the answer just is never really satisfying to me, because it feels like this sort of abdication of accountability. It's like, well, because that's what sells games, or like that's what we need to do because that's required. Where in the indie game scene, I get a real sense of accountability on every project. Like when I talk to the guys who make those games, they tell me, like, I made this game because this is exactly like what I wanted to do, and I'm the guy who decided, or I'm the girl who decided that this is the way it's going to be, and the buck stops with me. This was my concept from the beginning to the end. I'm not doing anything to sell the game. I want to make this game. Steve Gaynor's game, Gone Home, interestingly enough, who actually worked on BioShock Infinite, so it's a cool comparison. But that game, Gone Home, which have you played that at all, Michael?
Yes, I did. I played it up to the point that he was showing it.
I saw it in the IGF demo.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, right. I was going to say, Brett, it's an IGF game too. So
he's on another segment of our.
Oh, cool. All right.
So I talked to him along with Chris Sullentrop yesterday. So yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So that game is like, I think, a great example of authorship, like and like creator accountability. Like Steve and the rest of their team, and it's like four people or something. There's so much accountability in that game. When I play it, I just think, yeah, all right, this is the exact game they wanted to make. And that's really cool. Like, I value that a lot about the indie game movement, that these small teams allow the flexibility for there to actually be someone who will say, this is why this game is the way that it is. It's because I wanted it to be that way, and not just because we needed to put guns in it because we have so many people we have to pay and we have a publisher we have to please and it needs to be an action game.
You know, the impact of what that feels like when a player confronts something brand new is pretty amazing. I had the build that Steve gave me, and he was just sending out to people for feedback, you know, does this work, is this broken, you know, whatever. And I happened to be teaching a seminar at the time, and it was we were at the point where we were talking about indie games, and I thought, well, maybe could I just like show my students and 15 students this game at the point that it was, and Steve was okay with it, and so I brought it in and kind of just said nothing, just like handed a student the mouse and keyboard, and off they went. And it became sort of 75 minutes of these guys with their jaws open. Like, oh my God, what is this game? Where did you get this game? Who made this game? Like, what is this? And I'm thinking back to Well, and, you know, Brett, I've been thinking back to our old adventure game days, right? And LucasArts and, you know, being in a room and looking for stuff to pick up, and it tells me what I need to know to solve this. But our students, these guys don't have those experiences.
Right, yeah.
And they aren't, in mm-hmm. fact, drawing on those years of adventure game experiences. So now they're in this really cool, high-fidelity environment with it's extremely seductive. And it's drawing on all those old, beautiful adventure game sort of feelings, but in this deeply immersive environment. And these guys were just, they couldn't believe it.
That's so cool.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, and my son and my girlfriend's son both played the Room, the iOS puzzler, which is very adventure gamey. It's not, you know, there's not a lot of interaction that sort of, you know, it's abstract, puzzly, but they had a similar experience where they were really, you know, I think Joey, my girlfriend's son, I think he played it through 3 or 4 times. He was just like, you know, how quickly he could do the puzzles and things like that. He was making his own sort of goals. He's like, oh man, I did it in 1 hour and 15 minutes or whatever. You know, it's interesting for people to be rediscovering those. And I think it's been great to have, you know, to have them available on new platforms or, you know, on the PC as downloadable titles.
Yeah.
The hard thing, I think, is that it's difficult, right? I mean, your students were able to find that game by having you. It would be really difficult for people who might enjoy that game that don't have an in. I mean, people like my parents, you know, if I don't mention a game to them, they will not have heard of it, right? I mean, my father would not have heard of The Legend of Zelda, you know, if I had not said, oh, here, I have this Wii game that I finished, whatever, 6 years ago. That's both the strength and the curse of the indie scene in that respect, is it's really hard for them to break out and find audiences that might really appreciate what they do because it is different. I think there's a lot of people out there who have capable PCs who would love to play something new and interesting but don't really have the time to find it. And there's not an easy way for them to be curated to. And certainly those teams don't have the budgets to market, to reach, you know, that sort of audience at all. So that's a hard thing. I mean, I'll be telling everybody I know about Gone Home when it comes out. And any number of things I'll show people. But it's hard for them to find it.
Yeah, I'll apologize to anyone who's listened to previous segments because I've mentioned it before. But I struggle with this a lot. I have a very hard time convincing people around me to try indie games, that they really are still very bent towards those big flashy $60 games. And we sort of say, oh, shooters, who needs another one? Or, you know, oh, the indie game space is where all the action is. It's where all the interesting ideas are. We say that. My Twitter friends say that. I live in this little mini culture that says that, but they don't live there.
I kind of find that, like, so that's interesting. So I taught high school for a while and had that issue where I was writing about games and into games, but I would run a gaming club where at the place where I was teaching music, and I'd try to get them to play games. And it was a similar deal. I'd be like, you guys, I really have to play, you know, I think it was Flower at the time. You have to play Flower. It's really cool. You'll like it. And they were like, yeah, I don't know, whatever. Like, I'm not really that interested. And there'd always be the odd kid most of them wouldn't. Then starting at Kotaku, it's really similar where there was a real learning curve at Kotaku because, you know, you want to write articles that are going to be really interesting to a lot of people, like that are going to spread. That's sort of our mandate, is to get new readers on every article. So you want to write things that people like and be interested in and find cool and want to share and get around, which is kind of a good mandate. Like, it forces good writing habits. But there's this point when I started where there's a difference between an article where I was telling people to like something and where I was talking about something that I already knew people liked. And when I try to tell people to like something, they never respond well. Like, they just don't care. They don't want to hear that I think something's good. No matter how eloquently I'd put it, I'd spend forever like writing some really epic article about something I really, really care about, some music thing or some game that's really cool. And the response would just be tepid. It'd be like, it'd do medium traffic, and it gets some comments that are like, well, you really seem to like this game or something. Where, you know, where it's, if there's something about a game that everyone's really interested in that you have something to say about, obviously that'll do way, way better. So what I found is, and, you know, I've only been doing this for 1.5 years, but there is this way, like, so I look at The Walking Dead, for example, as a game where that's a game that is really good for a lot of the reasons that I want people to think games are good. And I really value a lot of that. But it also was really, really successful. And it was kind of, I mean, we were right at the forefront of, like, when the buzz was starting to generate for that game. And I played the first episode, and I remember being like, oh, wow, okay, this is really good. And I knew a couple of the Thumbs guys, Jake and Jake and Sean, who had, you know, worked on it. And I was like, okay, I had a feeling it would be good. And I played it. The first episode was good. We started writing about it. People started getting interested. We started kind of evangelizing. I think other people in the press did too, saying, hey, this is really good. But it also had an extra something that they put in the game. Mainly that I think that it was The Walking Dead, that it was like zombies and zombie survival. It was something that like gamers are already really familiar with, that the audience knows. And so it was like they snuck it in, you know. It was like this stealth kind of, they got a different kind of game in under the guise of genre and got a lot of people to play it. And that really worked well for them. I think that that's actually possible, that there is a way to, you know, if The Walking Dead had just been a game about, like, I don't know, surviving Katrina, like it had been the same story, but it had been Hurricane Katrina and you had to make all the same decisions, like everyone would have made a really big deal out of it. It would have gotten more kind of big press, and I'm sure the New York Times still would have written about it, but it wouldn't have had that like mega sale like gamer thing, where by sneaking it in with genre, I actually think that that works. So there is kind of a way to do it, I think. I'm just not sure anyone quite knows what the formula is.
Yeah, it's when you're saying that, it's making me think of how social commentary gets snuck into genre shows of all kinds, you know, going back to the original Star Trek series, right? I mean, for every terrible Spock's brain, you'd have the, you know, Spectre of the Gun or something.
Yeah.
You know, you had these episodes that, and that's been true, you know, in really good genre television ever since, that they're about a lot more than what their surface would indicate. And those shows sometimes connect really well.
Yeah, there's definitely a sweet spot with
right.
The Walking Dead. I'll just I can't help myself. I'll take it back one more step. You know, this is what Shakespeare did, right? He always buried the like stuff you really needed to know and important like plot stuff or thematic stuff into these wildly theatrical scenes. You know,
so yeah, absolutely.
Like ghosts
true.
On stage and witches and like all, and like his best stuff is always happening when he's absolutely got your attention. You know,
or Frank Zappa. Look at Zappa, composer who would write these amazing orchestral pieces and nobody listened to them. So he was like, okay, well, screw this. I'm starting a rock band.
Exactly. Yeah, and like, work all that stuff in there.
Right, but everybody listened to it. Yeah, no, it's the same idea, I think.
Like, yeah. Well, what do you see? This is prognostication time, so I realize this gets all tricky and no one really knows. But if you look into your crystal ball, what do you see on the horizon? Are you excited and positive about where we're going? Are there any dangerous currents out there that we should steer clear of?
I think like, well, and Brett, here's something I'm curious to know what you think of. And I know you, just based on what you can talk about, but when I saw the PS4 announcement, I was actually really, you know, the announcement itself, whatever, as a media circus, I didn't have too much of a strong opinion on it, but I thought that the system itself was cool. And I thought the way that they described it, especially as this very developer friendly PC like thing that was easy to make games for and powerful, like, I thought that was heartening. That made me, that was one of maybe two or three things that made me pretty excited about the idea of the PlayStation 4 and theoretically, you know, who knows, but theoretically the next Xbox. I wonder, like, if as a developer, if you heard that dog whistle, if that was something that, like, that I was picking up on that wasn't quite there or
Oh, no, I think that was absolutely there. And I think that Sony probably heard that a lot over the past few years. And it's interesting because the original PlayStation had perhaps some of the best developer support, and not that the subsequent ones haven't, but the machines have gotten significantly more complex to program for. You know, you went from the PlayStation, which was a pretty much, I mean, it wasn't by any means a PC, but it was PC-like in the sense that it was a simple instruction set and single-threaded, and that you could sort of keep everything in your brain about what was going on in that machine because it was 2 megs of memory. And then you went to the PS2, which had four, I think, different CPUs in it, one of which was a PlayStation 1, you know, and there was the Emotion Engine. They had these two VUs, and you had a graphics card, graphics chip. And then you went to the PlayStation 3, which was, was extremely elegant. I mean, I will say that I actually will miss it in the sense of it is, wow, I think, the right way to do parallel processing because of sort of technical details. I mean, shared memory is a really hard thing to scale up performance-wise because that's a resource that becomes a bottleneck. And the sort of PS3 is the cell processor was meant to fight that. I think we may see something like that again sometime later. I think it's a technology that was way too early. But I think we may see it again. And I think that's why it was so expensive for them to develop. I agree. It is totally heartening to developers to see machines that are more PC in nature, because then, you know, if you're making a big bet, it's a lot easier to know, okay, this is going to run on, you know, the next gen consoles. It's going to run on the high end PCs, or, you know, even a high end PC today, or what have you. And that makes it easier both to make those big bets, but also maybe to take more risks with those bets.
Well, right. And it's good for gamers. I mean, I think, like, so, you know, so Skyrim had, there was a lot of stuff with the PS3 version of that game, and it was, like, clearly harder to make that game, it seemed like. And with the PS4, like, with, or just with all this stuff, like, there's a, it's good for everyone on every system. Like, you're not going to get a system, like, one version of the game that was harder to make than the others, so it gets content slower or anything like that. Like, it, you know, they just announced, this is the littlest, stupidest announcement that only Kotaku would notice, or like a gaming site would notice, but it was that they're like, that NVIDIA's PhysX, you know, that physics software,
yes,
is going to be available on the PS4. And I thought that was cool, because, you know, it's all AMD stuff in the PS4, but they're also going to support PhysX, and it's kind of like everything is going to be together probably on every device. And it seems cool for just people who play video games, that no matter which version of a game you get, there's going to be a much more parity between all the systems, which is good for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the hard part, I think actually the difficulty is going to move away from developers, you know, because there will be so much commonality, and actually back onto the console brands themselves, mm-hmm, to distinguish. You know, what will, if they are all equally capable, and they sort of fought to say that was true in the last generation. Mm-hmm. And I remember early on, it was always, oh, here's the screenshot of the game running on this, and here's a screenshot running on this. You know, here's your best PC.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, I think that it's going to be, now that that parity will be more on parity, I should say.
Right.
I think it'll be tough for the console manufacturers. You know, they're going to have to distinguish themselves in a way. And I think that will be good for consumers, because the console manufacturers will be really pushing towards the consumer now as well, in even more of a way of why they're, you know, what they're doing for you that's so wonderful.
Should we be concerned that there appear to be so few, relatively few people clamoring for new hardware systems?
People, yeah, I get the sense that there are a lot of people who are thinking, really, I don't want to spend all this money on consoles again. Like, we have a lot of hardcore gamers that read Kotaku, and, you know, they have, a lot of them have every console, which is not actually that common. But if you're going to get every console this fall, like, if you bought a Wii U last Christmas and you're going to buy a PS4 and a Durango, whatever it's called, that's going to be like $1,000 just on hardware, just between those two systems, you know.
And what is the value?
Right, and what are you getting? And that's sort of this, right, and like, how is that different from your PC? Like, as we achieve the parity, and the parity you're talking about, Brett, it's like, there is this question of, okay, like, I don't play anything on my consoles, and it's not just because my PC, which is plugged into my TV, has better graphics. It's also the PC lets me do so much more. Like, I play Skyrim on it. I can mod the crap out of it. It looks amazing. I love using Steam. I use it to watch Hulu just through my browser. I don't have to subscribe to Hulu Plus. It's much better than my consoles in every way, except it can't do Kinect voice control. That's the only thing it can't do that my Xbox
right.
can do.
Yeah, but it's. Would you agree that Big Picture is one of the most underrated?
Oh, it's amazing!
Developments. I mean,
like,
it's
amazing.
Huge.
It's so amazing that, like, it makes. I feel like it's the one thing that clearly demonstrates how Origin and Uplay, how Origin and Uplay are inferior, because you can't do them with that. And you can even queue your Origin games up to play from Steam Big Picture mode, but then if you quit it, it goes back to Origin
exactly.
and it messes up your Big Picture, and it sucks. And it's like, this is, why can't everyone just use Steam?
I know.
Actually, not probably a very healthy
That's what Valve thinks.
That's what Valve wants, right.
Yeah, but in case people don't know what we're talking about, Big Picture is the mode that's Valve added to Steam that enables you to sort of do lean back gaming. It puts it on your TV, and it's basically very much like the interface you'd see on an Xbox or a PS3. So I know you can't, you know, play favorites and stuff, Brad, which I totally understand. But you know, a lot of people are interested in this Steam box. We've gotten a little bit more information about it a lot of it thanks to Kotaku, actually. And what it sounded like sort of offhand remarks Jason got from, I don't know, maybe you know more about that story than I do.
But from Gabe?
From Gabe, yeah. That he sort of broke that story and suddenly there was all this information that nobody else had.
I think it was at the VGAs, right? Like he just ran Gabe down real quick at the line and was like, hey, Gabe, you got time for a 5-minute interview? And he's like, sure. And he just asked me, like, what's up with the Steam Box? And he was like, oh, well, here's all this information about it.
Here's an information dump just for you.
It was like on our site. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, I was wondering when somebody was going to ask, you know.
That way, right? Where everyone's curious and like, well, because they're really inaccessible, Valve, right? That was really funny where he's just asked him and he's like, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's exciting. And we kind of get the idea of what the consoles are about, and they're going to add more, you know, sort of living room features to them. Obviously they'll do what they can to keep us interested. But do you see this potential Steam Box and the various iterations of it? I guess there'll be more and less expensive versions and stuff. Is that exciting to you as well, Brett?
Yeah, it definitely is in the way that the PC is exciting to me. I mean, I didn't technically start on a PC. I started on a mainframe, but after that I had a PC. I think that I'm always happy to see that it's still the frontier in a lot of ways. Not necessarily Steam itself, but although they have the green light, you know, and they're trying to open that walled garden even more. And Gabe's been talking about that. We enjoy a healthy relationship with them. We really love them. I mean, they helped us integrate the workshop stuff, to make the mods easy to distribute and all that. So, I mean, we really appreciate them. We think they do great work. So it is exciting. It's still, from a developer perspective, consoles are still wonderful because it's the same console house to house. You know, every PS3 is the same. Aside from, you know, certain hardware revs or whatever. But, I mean, it's all the same. You can sort of expect this is the minimum, you know, guaranteed performance of a PS3. And this is exactly what you will have in a PS4, guaranteed lifetime of the box. And that was mostly true of the 360 as well. So there's sort of trade-offs there. As I play everything. You know, I don't have a Wii U yet. I haven't bought into anything next-gen. But I've had every system and always had a PC or two. I also have a Mac. I mean, I've got an iPad. I mean, I've got gaming devices surrounding me all the time. And I don't really put one above the other as a player. I get certain experiences in certain places. You know, I think that the consoles will continue to have tentpole exclusive games that are hard to get elsewhere. I mean, they still have first parties that are valuable. You know, certainly Sony has quite a number, and Microsoft certainly does as well. Nintendo will always have its first-party primacy as well. You know, they're kind of on a different, they've kind of gone in a different direction altogether, but you know, they still enjoy some very, very well-loved properties. So I think that those are the things that are going to continue to drive those machines. It's just that, hey, if you have one of those, you're not only going to have the ability to play that sort of first-party stuff. You'll be able to play lots and lots of multi-platform stuff because of these sort of hardware parity.
You know, it's funny. I look at some of this stuff. I do think that, like, I think this is, I keep coming back to this. I've been talking to people about this kind of thing, and I keep coming back to Jason Schreier's theory that he said this. And I don't even know. I feel like I keep putting words in his mouth, and I'm not sure how strongly he feels this. But he's put forth this idea that it could well be that in like 10 years, there aren't consoles from Sony and Microsoft. They're just PCs. Like, we just use some kind of Steam Box that has, you know, more universal hardware in it. But that Nintendo is still making their own thing. Like, that Nintendo is still, like, right now, it kind of feels like the bloom is off the Wii U rose a little bit. There aren't that many games for it. And nobody gets what they're going to do once everyone's making PS4 games. But then they're going to release a Zelda game for it, or a 3D Mario game, or some other amazing thing.
Animal Crossing.
And yeah, right, or Animal Crossing. And everyone will be, like, just like with the 3DS, like, it'll be, oh, well, this thing is great for what it does. It's great for these games. I think Sony has, like, I get the sense that they still have these really great studios making games. Like, Naughty Dog is great. That game company is probably still going to do a lot of great stuff. They have all these JRPGs and like Tales games and all this. You know, Atlus is kind of, well, might go multi-platform, but they used to be like, they're kind of Sony's people, like with Persona. So there's kind of still a lot of games coming out on the probably for the PS4. I'm a little less sure about the next Xbox, actually, like in terms of the Microsoft's focus on having first party developers. Like, I don't, you know, and I don't know, I don't really know who's working on what, but we know Epic is like kind of just off in the wind right now. They're not, I don't think, working on another Gears of War game for the next Xbox. You know, there's definitely going to be another Halo on the next Xbox, but past that, like, Rare isn't really doing anything. Like, I kind of worry about the next Xbox sometimes, like when I hear about it, like in terms of what exclusive games it'll have, like what it'll actually have to recommend it to me above just getting a PC, installing Windows 8, and plugging that into my TV. Like, I don't see that big of a difference, probably because of Microsoft, probably just because, I don't know, like, I don't see it. So I already start to feel like maybe the Xbox is starting to feel a little less relevant to me, but I don't know. We haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll look forward to reading about it on Kotaku.
Yeah, we'll probably be the ones with the hot scoops.
Well, if there is first-person shooter fatigue, that phenomenon hits the Xbox harder than it does any other console. So
right.
Sure, if that is a real thing. What's your take on Nintendo? Nintendo always seems to be the thing you talk about after you've talked about the big trend, you know, and then there's the Nintendo side of it, you know, which is always somehow on a separate track.
It's funny how and they do that and it works. Like, I never had a Nintendo growing up, and I was never a big Nintendo gamer. I didn't, you're not going to believe this, I didn't own a Wii, like, ever, really. I borrowed my cousin's Wii for a while to play Skyward Sword, but I never really had one. I didn't own until I got a Wii U, I didn't own a Nintendo home console. I had a DS. But what I watched with the 3DS was they announced the thing. There was a lot of hype about the 3D thing and, you know, Reggie coming out at GDC to show it and talk about it, and everyone thought it looked so sweet. And then we got it and it was kind of weird and the 3D thing sucks and no one uses it. And then there was a while where people were saying, oh, this is Nintendo's first big folly, you know, the 3DS is this failure. And then good games started coming out. And then I guess it was like two Christmases ago, when they finally had all these really good games, and now that it's doing really great. And
and that XL is sweet.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah.
That is a fantastic handheld system.
Like, that came out, and then Fire Emblem came out afterwards. And I'm like, I play everything on 3DS now.
Yeah. But they seem to have historically been able to through the force of their will, they overcome all the naysayers, you know, or through coming up with something innovative that everyone thinks will fail.
Well, it's more than just will. I mean, I think they've always been extremely savvy businessmen as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, I mean, it's easy to say, well, they kind of bowl through and they ultimately, you know, even with something that may not start out very well. I mean, you have to keep in mind that, you know, every console they've ever sold, they've sold at a profit, you know, which has not been true of other console developers, you know, and you know, they've always targeted a price point and built the best hardware that they could build for that price point and sought innovation in other ways that would bring something new. I mean, I think that's a business strategy that has continued to work for them. And so things may seem gimmicky when they come out and you go, I don't know if that'll work. They are taking kind of a flyer, maybe a little bit, in the sense that, well, you know, we believe that the games will come, and certainly Nintendo always seems to deliver something that makes use of the hardware in a great way. But they're still making money on every piece of hardware.
Right.
You know, that's a powerful business model. You know, it continues to work for them. I mean, they really lose if nobody buys it. You know, that's the only situation under which they would lose badly. I think that's been a real strength for them. And they are, you know, they're more capitalized than Toyota. I mean, they have a lot of money.
Yeah. Do you guys have time for just one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
What we haven't talked about too much is sort of game culture. Those of us who care about games, enthusiasts and the like, who are kind of in the middle of this space, and probably the people listening to this show, do you think that we are getting anywhere that we can be proud of? Is it possible for us to look at? I'm asking this kind of informed by a few things that have happened lately. I could mention many of them. Kirk, you would know probably better than both of us about kind of the ebb and flow of these things. But I'll just pick out one. There's a piece, this really cool piece that you wrote about Kirk. It's a video series that Anita Sarkeesian came out with, and it's called Tropes Versus Women. And what's cool about it, and what it suggests to me about quote-unquote gamer culture, is that, you know, we're getting very sophisticated in the ways that we can think of and talk about games, and they border on gender politics, identity, issues of violence and media representation, all kinds of interesting things. My wife teaches gender studies. I have a colleague in rhetoric. They're both connected to this video suddenly, and they're wildly interested in it. So, like, what you do with these game things is branching out into some really interesting conversations that make me sort of proud to be part of this community. Mm-hmm. And then I read the comments.
Oh, no, don't.
So
don't
yeah,
read,
which is
that was your first mistake. Your first mistake was reading the comments.
Granted, it is a mistake, but on the other hand, it is also reality, right? It is, It is a thing. You know, you write a piece and it gets like, 250 or 300 comments. There's always a lot of vigorous commentary. I don't know what. Maybe you would know better than I. That last time I looked at that piece, I think it had like 1,200 comments.
I have a whole relationship with comments because we moderate comments and we're doing more commenting. We're getting ready to sort of launch a whole new redesign that'll change a lot of stuff about our comments again and kind of reset a lot of bars, which will be nice. We tend to go through comments and read them, and I don't actually, you know, that you can dismiss, like move comments just to the back of the row if they're just totally lame and useless. I found a lot of the comments on Anita's video, and I was policing those pretty carefully because, of course, there's going to be, especially with her, because, you know, the thing with Anita is that it's not just that she's talking about Tropes Versus Women in Games and her series. It's also the whole story, which I trust that you guys know. But, you know, the Kickstarter and the harassment campaign,
right,
and everything that happened, that became a bigger story than the video.
And that's an extraordinary story, by the way. It's, you know.
And she's really cool. She's a really awesome person in general. Like, I really like, I respect her a lot.
In case people don't know, she put up a thing to say, I'd like a little bit of money to start this project. And she got way more money than she asked for from supporters.
She asked for $6,000 and got $160,000, which was partly, I think, fueled by this backlash. So, and
yeah,
that,
I absolutely. It was a backlash to the backlash.
Yeah, great. Well
it was
put.
It was like basically 4chan and Reddit came after her, and in the most just vile, horrible way I've ever seen anyone be treated by the internet, you know, by the internet at large. And then what was interesting about her video was that there was, I mean, we would get, I can't even, people are so weird about Anita. Like, there was a whole group of people who were convinced that she'd taken everybody's money and wasn't making her series, which, you know, like, I knew she was making her series. Like,
yeah, that's crazy. I mean, she's been making video commentary about feminist issues, you know, for quite some time. It's insane to think that she wasn't doing this.
She got extra money. Just, it expanded the project, but it meant that it took longer. And it also meant that she wanted to be, I think, really careful that it was really good, because she knew there was going to be this huge amount of scrutiny on it. So then the video came out and it was really good, right? Like, I thought it was great. It was thoughtful and really, I thought, really, like, to the point, just well put together, concise. It just had a bunch of ideas right in a row and a lot of information and good context. And then it was over. And it was like, I was fascinated by, I'll be really curious to see what kind of a deflating effect that has in general on this kind of balloon of hate that's sprung up around her. I think that it'll have a significant one. I hope so anyways, because a lot of these weird, whoever, I think mostly young or immature guys who are just idiots, these men's rights advocates, these 4chan Reddit people who would write her these horrible things and make these horrible images, would just see it and say, okay, well, there's a video. I don't, you know, really agree with this part of it or something, but it's just a video and it's there and it's real and it's no longer this boogeyman. So I'm glad about that. Like, I think that the video is cool and it's just nice that it exists now and it's going to be a series. We all know what to expect. All, even her detractors can just see it and say, okay, well, there it is. And there's going to be another 8 of these or something.
Yeah,
like
that's
that.
Important to point out. It's part one. It's part one of, she's got, you know, many
that's
more.
A lot of comments being like, this cost $160,000.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Just, you know, read the text.
Right, right. But of the comments,
or listen to the first sentence.
Yeah, good point.
It's not a, you know, part one. I mean, it's in the title. You don't even have to watch it.
I have way too high expectations.
Yeah, I know.
Is this really a distortion? The loudest assholes jump out of their seats and run to their keyboards, and the silent majority sort of shakes their heads. Is this really a distortion? There's no way of knowing, I suppose, but what do you think?
I think it is. I mean, we at LucasArts, because that was my first exposure to this, and it was kind of coming up at the same time. We would, of course, the day a game came out, one of our games, we'd go and running, and you know, our project leaders who had been through it before would be like, okay, you know, I just want to, you know, you need to take all of this with a grain of salt. You need to accentuate the positives, feel proud of what you've done. You felt proud about what you did before, you know, anybody looked at it. You have the same reason to be proud of it now. And I think that's certainly true of Anita's work. It's fantastic. I watched it within minutes of it coming out. But I think that there is a deeper, if you like, silent majority. My first project leader, Darren Stinnett, I flippantly said, you know, one day, well, you know, we're not curing cancer. We make video games. And he said, yeah, but that's an easy thing to say, but we are connecting people in ways that, you know, these people are finding ways to connect through our experiences that they might not have had otherwise. I mean, he had been in flight sims before that at MicroProse. And he had gone to a con of some kind that was specifically people who loved F-14 series or something. And, you know, he's like, these were lots of people who came together and had this sort of shared love of this thing that, you know, I had a hand in making. And that's really powerful. I've been really humbled. I see both sides of this from the sort of Skyrim stuff as well. And it's really humbling to see the extremely positive things that come out. You know, I think that this week there was... We had all signed a book for someone who had lost his sister.
Oh, I saw that. That was amazing.
Around the time that Skyrim came out, and it was, yeah. I mean, we just kind of did that thing, and it's really. I think that there's a lot more positive out there than we see, because it's easy to be anonymous and an asshole on the internet. But I think we actually are still making meaningful connections with people. And bringing something into their life that they really enjoy. I mean, they wouldn't be doing it otherwise. I think there is, and I hope there is, that silent majority. I think it's just really easy to hide behind, you know, some crazy combination of letters and say whatever dark things come out of your id. I mean, I've always prided myself that when I'm on the internet, it's Brett Duville. That's my Yahoo email. My Gmail. It's every way I present myself to the world is... as this one, this is who I am, you know, talk to me. You know, I still occasionally will get those sort of weird direct addresses through Twitter where you're like, I have no idea what to do with this person. You know, hey, it's, you know, obviously something really pissed you off today and happy to have it roll off my back. But, you know, I'm not going to engage. I mean, it's not interesting to me to engage. Mm-hmm.
I suppose she doesn't need me to worry about her. I mean, I presume I've never met her, but I presume she's a tough cookie and she's going to be just fine. But I hate it that this is the cost, that she has to, she gets this sort of withering, even if it is this crazy lunatic fringe, that it's so loud and it's so ugly and she's got to just sort of persevere through it. Again, it's probably not going to stop her. If nothing else, it'll probably motivate her even more. But the only thing I worry about is that it sort of becomes like politics, that some of the very best people that you wish would run for something just won't, because they don't want to get into that cesspool. Mm-hmm. And they know that what it means and all the ugliness that's going to come with it, it's just ultimately not worth it. That doesn't mean that really good people don't get involved, but it just means that there's a real good chance that somebody who is really good might think twice, and I just hate that that's the case.
Yeah, especially somebody who's particularly sensitive. It's something you have to grow a skin about. I mean, hopefully you start off small and you know don't take quite as much fire before you become kind of acclimatized to it. I think one thing that's actually been nice in the past year is I think that this sort of thing has reflected very poorly on the Reddit people and less so on, you know, fans of games, for example, or whatever. I mean, this wasn't the only story, you know, that came out of Reddit being kind of a horrible place at times. There are lots of, I mean, and there are lots of great communities on Reddit. Don't get me wrong, but there was a story I heard about it on the Slate Culture Gabfest, and it had been reported maybe in the New Yorker or something about a Redditor who had been tracked down and identified.
Oh, that was Gawker, actually. That was us. So that,
oh, that was
Adrian,
Gawker. I'm sorry.
Adrian Chen's story. Yeah, yes, on Violent Acres. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That I couldn't remember the details, but I remember thinking this doesn't reflect poorly on creators.
No.
This reflects poorly on assholes, right? Which is the way it should be.
Right.
You know, and that was really I hope that's the story that is reaching the broader public, that you know, that yeah, there's an anonymity that comes with the internet that allows people to, you know, kind of be the worst that they can be. But there's also the opportunity to connect and find better parts of your nature. And you have to be open to that.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I try to really communicate that to people a lot, to just the idea that, you know, when people will, like, we'll have people write a guest post for us or something, or we'll republish a blog post, which, you know, and I got republished before I worked for Kotaku. That was one of my, you know, ways of breaking in, was that I got a couple articles republished. And so you go from writing stuff, you know, writing your ideas down and putting them on your blog and having like the five people who read your blog read it and one person comment, to suddenly it's on Kotaku and you have like 500 comments, and they're immediate and they're really opinionated and they're all over the place and you have no idea who these people are. And it's really overwhelming. Where, you know, now when I do that to people, I try to explain, you know, we have all this transparency with numbers, and you can see how many people read it versus how many people commented, and how many people liked it on Facebook versus how many people commented, and how many of the comments were good and bad. And to kind of, it's really easy to lose perspective on that. And it's like human, it's just normal. I don't know if there's any way to not lose perspective, to not think like, I'll think, oh, I shouldn't write this article because people will bitch about it. But when I'm thinking people will bitch about it, like five people, literally five people in the comments will bitch about it out of the like 75,000 people that will wind up reading the article or something. So that's a crazy decision to make, to not make five people who are constant commenters unhappy because I'm writing about something that they don't want to see, when in fact, like tons and tons of people who will just read it and think, oh, well, there was an article I read that was good, and then move on with their lives. We'll read it. And it's so hard to communicate that. Like, I try to repeat it to people over and over, because I always see on Twitter, and I'm sure you guys see this, as we follow a lot of the same people, is people will have these immediate Kotaku reactions. Oh, why did I read the comments? Oh, the Kotaku comments are such a cesspool. Oh, it's the worst. It's the worst. It's the worst. Where I really try to say, yeah, but like, we wrote this article about this thing that's really important. And so far, all these people have read it. There are thousands of people reading it this very second. And yeah, there are some jerks in the comments saying stupid things, but they're a tiny percentage of who will actually read it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Well, I can say this because you're my guest, and you wouldn't say it about yourselves, but you know, the best thing you can do in the community, if you want to make a difference, is to care and to try to help people and to sort of be nurturing souls. And both of you, I've seen you do this many times on Twitter. With people who are suffering, or people who are being attacked, or just simply encouraging people to think, you know, constructively about something that everyone's sort of hating on. You both very often model that kind of behavior, and it's important. It's been a through line in these sessions that I've had this week. We've each one of us has lamented this culture in one way or another, but also aware that, just what you said, Kirk, it's bigger than that. It's bigger than that. But there still have to be people in that community who model a different behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, you guys both do it. You do it a lot, and so, you know, I'll thank you for it, and I'll point people to, you know, pick you up on Twitter, follow you, and you'll see what I mean.
Well, you do it too, Michael. I mean, I feel like I saw your example when I first started getting into writing about games, and I was like, this is the nicest guy to ever talk about video games. I'm totally into this.
Yeah, and one of the things that, you know, in this discussion that I remember very cogently was your discussion of, hey, you know, we're not ruining your fun. You know, and you were mostly talking about examining games and looking at them, you know, under a magnifying glass. But I think it covers all of this, is that, yeah, you know, Anita Sarkeesian's looking at some of the tropes that have been employed historically and continue to be employed today. That's not going to harm your fun.
Yeah.
Right.
The games will still be fun. You know, you can have, you know, a very exciting experience. I mean, I like to think Skyrim is one we're completely gender neutral, at least in terms of the player character. I mean, I'm sure there's specific stuff that goes on in quests that I probably haven't even seen, and I've played a lot. But you know, you go in and you can be whoever you want, and that's been a part. That's one of the things I love about our games.
Yeah.
You know, so it you can have the same fun without a lot of that, you know, sort of casing, for want of a better word.
It's the number one thing that I get by far. It's that you're reading into these games. You academics are going to academic games. You know, you're going to ruin games. We don't need to, you know, this as if we'll somehow destroy.
Right.
You're going to ruin this just like you ruined Shakespeare.
It's like a weird fear of knowledge, though, right? Like, I think that, like, and that sounds, you know, I don't know. Like, I think that we have, there's like a knee-jerk reaction to, like, I don't want to know. I don't want to, like, I'm afraid of that. Like, I just want to kind of embrace not thinking about it. And that's actually kind of a really broad thing in general that people do. But yeah, I don't get it either.
It's never been easier in human history to turn that channel off.
Right. It's just like, go play the game, man. You don't have to go read Brainy Gamer.
just turn that off, man. Like, seriously, I'm not in your town. I'm not on a soapbox. I'm not, like, giving a speech in your school. Like, you know, it's...
Yeah, you came to me.
I know. I'm just the digital thing out here. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a weird sort of aggressive
thing. Yeah, it is. Well, this has been terrific. I've enjoyed this conversation very much. I just casually looked at my clock and I thought, oh my God, I didn't realize I kept you for so long. So I'm sorry I kept you longer than I said I
would. Oh, not at all. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed it very much. I hope our listeners will too. You guys are great. I'll link to your work and all of that when I post the podcast, which will be soon. And I hope maybe you guys will come back and chat with me again sometime.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Thanks very much for having me, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Michael.
My pleasure. Happy gaming.